You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast, which is recorded in the hours after the conclusion of George Osborne's public spending review speech in the House of Commons. My name is Chris Parr, and today we'll be discussing the content of that spending review, along with a couple of other articles from this week's magazine, of course. Unfortunately, the magazine did go to press before Mr. Osborne took to the podium, so it just gives a chance to cover a few of the things that we didn't get into the mag. I'm joined by reporter David Matthews, news editor Simon Baker, Deputy News Editor John Morgan. Later in the programme, we'll hear a bit about what the OECD had to say about the UK's higher education sector in its Education at a Glance report. David will tell us a bit more about what he and the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, spoke about recently. But first, unsurprisingly, we'll touch on today's spending review. If you're listening to this, it'll probably be yesterday's spending review. But we'll just sort of get a little bit of a feel for what the reaction was in the newsroom to Mr. Osborne's words. Simon, I suppose, is a good place to start with this. We've been frantically getting stories out. What are the initial sort of findings of his speech?
Well, with any spending review or budget, it's always fun and games, basically, because the speech itself is usually a positive spin on the figures, and then basically it slowly starts to unwind as you look at the documents and analyse the figures and try and work out whether what was said in the speech is actually what has happened. But you know, the top lines that came out of the speech really on the spending review for HE anyway was that BIS has seen a 6% cut in the cost of the department, and that was the actual phrase that was used, which, you know, on the face of it seems like a bit less than the 8% figure that was being touted around the other day, and obviously a lot less than the 10% figure that was feared at one point. So from that point of view, it seems like a good settlement. Science ring fence continues, although of course that's a cash. It's just freezing the science budget in cash terms. So for another year, inflation is eroding basically spending on resource spending on science. The better news for science is that there's been a boost to capital spending, so it'll be £1.1 billion in 2015-16, which, other than the last spending review, is a lot of criticism because they cut capital spending quite a lot, and then they've spent the last few years kind of replacing some of that funding. How far that is an increase is unclear at the moment, and they've also guaranteed that all capital spending on science will increase in real terms till the end of the decade. So, I mean, that's quite good news. So, you know, so there'll be a mixed reaction, I think, on the science front. On the rest of the HE budget, you know, we're still going through the details, but one of the headline things is they've saved some money basically by cutting £100 million from the National Scholarship Programme.
Yeah, this was an interesting line that came out, wasn't it? Perhaps a bit of an embarrassment for the Lib Dems, I think. John, you've been furiously tweeting and indeed writing about the review all afternoon. What's we've got more on that programme?
So this wasn't mentioned by George Osborne in his speech.
Surprisingly.
So the Treasury document, published as soon as he sat down, reveals that the National Scholarship Programme is to be refocused as a £50 million fund for postgraduates. The Treasury document didn't mention the fact that this was supposed to be worth £150 million and go towards undergraduates. So it's kind of drawing a veil over the fact that it's been scrapped for undergraduates, the NSP, and it's been cut by £100 million. Can't think why the Treasury didn't mention that. But you're right, this is embarrassing for the Liberal Democrats.
It's a bit of a flagship for them, wasn't it?
They championed the NSP. It was meant to offer, you know, financial support for individual undergraduates under the new 9K system. So it's something of a climb down, the fact that it's gone, but it hadn't been well received by the sector generally. So there may not be that many tears shed over its going, but, you know, £100 million cut is £100 million cut.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we'll be crunching those figures all afternoon. The best place for you to get the coverage of the higher education implications of the spending review is, of course, timeshighereducation.co.uk. There's several stories up there as we speak. They'll be updated throughout the day, so do head over there to get the latest. But tomorrow we also have a new magazine out. One of the features in that sees David, you speaking to Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, now Master of Magdalen College in Cambridge. Before we hear from you, let's just have a little excerpt from that interview.
Well, what about this idea of the universities to get involved, you know, really almost at primary level to kind of encourage children to go to university?
Well, I know. Well, exactly, yes. That's what the inter-university network seeks to do. Our own college in Cambridge has a rolling programme of involvement with secondary schools. Maybe we go to primary schools, I don't know, but I'm in touch with a lot of primary schools and talk to them about their future when I'm there. We have a programme of visits, conferences, going out to where people are, not waiting for them to come to Cambridge.
Okay.
There's a lot there. A lot more could be done, and I think it's really creative and interesting work. I think all Cambridge colleges I know are upping their game in this respect in terms of access, I think.
You mentioned just earlier on, it's interesting, you said some universities wrongly elite universities. I've seen that phrase since I've worked in Times Higher. It's kind of,
I'm rather tired of the word elite university because it suggests inevitably this is for the select few. If you talk about a university that sets world class standards, you know, that takes away some of the rather suspicious element of the word elite.
Okay. So we should abandon the word elite, perhaps?
I wouldn't mind it if we did.
Okay, very.
So, David, yes, Lord Williams of Oystermouth there speaking to you on access, on the term elite, whether we should use it or not. Where did this interview take place, and what other things did you touch on?
Well, I interviewed Lord Williams at an event to mark his the announcement that he'll become the Chancellor of the very new University of South Wales, which is a merged institution. And he's got quite an interesting position in HE now, because he's both Master of Magdalen College in Cambridge and also Chancellor of this new university in Wales. So I spoke to him at a sort of evening event in Whitehall there, and we had a sort of quite informal interview, both leaning against a sort of fireplace because there wasn't much other room to do it. But he spoke about quite a few things, and as you mentioned, I think one of the most interesting things he said was that calling universities elite puts off poorer, more disadvantaged students. And I certainly seem, it feels like that word has been used more and more, not least by us and other parts of the media of the past few years. To be fair, it's often applied to the Russell Group, and to be fair, they don't really use it in any of their publicity. So I just wonder, I don't know whether it puts people off. I mean, it's kind of correct in the sense that they are elite, but and they are socially elite as well. There's no two ways about it in terms of the number of people from private schools are there. But should we stop using it because it puts people off?
I don't know. I think that runs the risk of belittling people from, you know, perhaps less prestigious backgrounds or more impoverished backgrounds. Surely they can aspire to be elite just as much as anyone else can be. I mean, did he give any sort of?
Yeah, it's hard to deny that Oxford and Cambridge are elite universities. You have to have extremely high attainment to get into them. Surely that's the name, that is an elite.
Yes, I don't think there's any doubt that it's correct, but whether we should change our language to encourage people, maybe that's the university's problem rather than the media's problem.
I think the difficulty is, from an editorial point of view, is often, you know, so many stories are about the kind of segregation of the higher education between different types of universities. So if you're writing about them, how you need to describe those sets of universities as against the others, because often that's the way the debate is framed, isn't it? So how you need words to describe those, and research intensive doesn't cut it, unfortunately, because that can refer to quite a lot of universities.
Yeah, but then again, within the Russell Group itself, there's enormous differences in entry standards and how much research funding they get. So describing just the Russell Group as elite is maybe, I don't know, maybe that needs a bit more nuance. But anyway, that was one of his major points.
Yeah, no, there's much more on that in the issue as well. A great interview to get and well worth a read too. This week's Splash actually focuses on the OECD report. Again, there's a bit more about this on the website. There were some top line findings in there about funding. Between 2005 and 2010, the UK's spending per student fell 3% against an 8% average rise across the OECD. The UK was one of the only five nations out of the 31 for which data is available in which funding per student fell. Those are some of the things that were covered elsewhere. But John, you had this story. You went in with a slightly different line. What did you draw from your discussions? I believe you went to the press conference for the OECD report.
That's right. So there was some surprisingly strong criticism of the US and its high tuition fees from the OECD, and an implicit warning to the UK not to go down that road of high fees and letting the market rip. And so this was Andreas Schleicher, the Deputy Director for Education and Skills at the OECD, who gave the briefing. He's an extremely respected figure within education, much admired by people such as Michael Gove. And he gave some very strong criticism of the US, warning that once you open the door and let the market regulate entirely, you're going to see what you saw in the US. And it is pinpointed in the OECD's report that the US is once again the clear as the highest spender on HE, spending 2.8% of GDP on higher education in 2010. And all that rise has come from fees. So it's undeniable that the US is racing ahead on fees, and the OECD are warning the UK not to go down that road.
It's all coming out of letting the market decide, basically. That's the fear, isn't it? If you leave it to the whims of the market, then there's only one way that the fees seem to go.
It's quite interesting. It's sort of economics, isn't it, really, when you think about it? It's not that far different from the housing market in some ways, because you're talking almost like a fixed supply of very valuable brands, basically, that people want those brands so they can then go on and get very high paid jobs. Well, if there's a limited supply of places at those universities, then the only thing that's going to go up is the price, really. What does it say about the underlying value of what you're actually getting at those universities?
I think if there's one thing you can learn from the US, universities can always find something else to spend more money on, whether it's buildings or perhaps higher wages for those at the top of the tree, but also you're kind of buying entry into an alumni network as well, and as you say, getting those jobs. So I suppose it's supply and demand, as you say.
Yeah, I agree with the point about the housing market. It's somewhere that in the US, you know, prices come completely detached from value added, just as it is with houses in the UK. There's no relation between price and value anymore.
Yeah, it's all to do with fixed supply at the end of the day, and I don't know if
bubbles usually burst. It's just a question of whether that's going to happen with US higher education. Probably not at the top end.
Interesting stuff. Well, obviously one place universities get money is from students, another is from donations. It's worth flagging up before we go our cover feature this week, written by Chris Higgins, Vice Chancellor and Warden at Durham University. He's talking about the protocols universities have in place for accepting donations. It's well worth a look. There's certainly been plenty of scandals down the years about where those donations originate, so an interesting discussion from him in this week's cover feature. Also, I should flag up a second podcast which came out just a few days ago, in which Karen Shook, our books editor, speaks to the University of Essex Deputy Vice Chancellor Jules Pretty, who reviewed last week's Book of the Week for us. So check that out too. But until next week's issue review, you can discuss all the articles that we've heard about today on our website. That's timeshighereducation.co.uk. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on LinkedIn, we're on Google+. Just put Times Higher Education into your search engine and you'll find us on all those platforms. But until next week, that's the end of the Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.